Hi, welcome to Screening Room with Chet and Dee. I'm Chet.
And I'm Dee.
I'm a boomer.
And I'm a millennial. And we both love classic movies.
And we think you're going to love them too if you give them a shot.
Which is where we come in.
We're here to talk about those old movies. We'll tell you a little bit about why we like them and how they were made.
And we'll also talk about what those movies can teach us about history, about people.
And maybe even about the meaning of life. Good movies try to do that.
And that's why we want you to watch them.
Okay.
All right. So it's our first podcast of the new year.
It is.
2023.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to start off with a depressing movie.
No, we're not. We're going to talk about a comedy. We're going to talk about a comedic.
A dark comedy?
No, not a dark comedy. It's a black and white comedy, but it's not dark at all. It is 1938. It is during the Depression. We can talk about that. It's during the Depression, but it is not a depressing movie. It is 1938's screwball classic, maybe the screwiest screwball comedy classic of all time.
Bringing up. Baby,
yes, starring
Loretta Ullman.
No, actually,
it's not starring my baby?
No, it's not starring your baby. You're bringing up your baby elsewhere, but not during this podcast. We should mention, though, too. See, Dee, of course, is producing this week, but her assistant producer, Loretta.
I had to give her a break.
Yeah, well, I thought she was working on another project for somebody else. But in any case, she's not here this week. So unfortunately, if you're listening for Baby Squeals,
I could add that. Well, that's something I could bring to the table.
It would not be an actual baby. It might be one of us, but no Baby Squeals for bringing up Baby.
She did enjoy this movie, though.
Oh, very much. I think, yeah.
I think I can speak on her behalf. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Well, she has excellent taste in films. We've established that already.
She's like, some people are well read.
She's well watched. Well, yes, well viewed.
She's well watched too.
Yeah. Yes.
I watch her like a hawk. Okay, so it's starring a couple actors we have never talked about.
Have we actually not talked about?
We did talk about. Sorry, Bishop's Wife. My bad.
Oh yes, yeah.
Bishop's Wife.
We've done one Cary Grant film. Even though Cary Grant has been making movies, he's already got like 20 movies to his credit at this point. This is like his first, and this movie actually was not a hit at the time. He was still waiting for his first big hit. In fact, he was like in his 30s and starting to wonder if it was ever going to happen for him.
There's still time for me.
Yeah, there is still time. There's still time for you. Because Cary Grant didn't really make it big until after this movie, sometime in his mid-30s, and then he just never stopped. And Katharine Hepburn also, even though Katharine Hepburn is, she'd already won an Oscar. She won her first Oscar. By the time this movie comes along, and this movie does not do well either, Katharine Hepburn gets this label as box office poison.
Poison.
Yeah, the critics don't like her anymore, and the Hollywood establishment doesn't like her anymore.
And she had just gotten started. And it was like, oh, yeah, it's the beginning of the end. And they gave her some B-roll.
That's right.
B-movie roles.
Yeah, so the lesson is, if you've heard of Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, and I would hope you have, even if you haven't watched any of their films, you know that these are two of the biggest stars ever, ever, ever in Hollywood. They make this movie, and even though this movie
we're not talking about Audrey Hepburn. For the millennials that might be thinking, oh, they hear Hepburn.
Right.
They're thinking of the famous pearl necklace, sunglasses.
Yeah.
No.
No, not that one.
That's Audrey Hepburn.
The other one. Katharine Hepburn.
No relation.
Right. So even though this movie today is considered one of the greatest screwball comedies, one of the greatest comedies, period, of all time.
What is a screwball?
Well, this is it's interesting that you should ask that. A screwball comedy, it's kind of like a farce, okay? And now you're going to ask me...
What's a farce?
What's a farce? Okay. A farce is kind of like a situational comedy. It's like all sorts of... bizarre circumstances start coming together and funny things just start happening to the characters. It's not a character about so much human nature or relationships or whatever. It's just wild stuff starts happening. And a screwball comedy is kind of a variation. They really just... Howard Hawks, I think, even coined this term when he was talking about this film, because he said there aren't any straight characters in this film. Everybody is screwy. It's a screwball comedy. And whether he or not he came up with the term, it doesn't matter. But a lot of these movies started coming out in the 1930s, and they are these farces. There's slapstick in it. There's physical comedy. There's gags. There's all kinds of stuff going on. It's fast-paced action. It's just kind of screwy. It's madcapped. It's zany. That's a screwball comedy. And this is probably the best of the... Well, we could argue about that. In fact, when we said that we were going to do a comedy, we really had a hard time deciding which comedy would be the first big screwball comedy that we did, right?
And we were trying to decide between this movie and My Favorite Wife, starring Cary Grant as well. But, yes. And then Irene Dunne.
Oh, yeah. And that's a fantastic movie. That even might be my favorite. It might be tied with this one for my favorite comedy of all time, certainly of this era. The Awful Truth is also excellent. That's another Cary Grant and Irene Dunne feature. There's The Philadelphia Story is great. It's a little slower paced, but maybe a little bit deeper than some of these others.
And it's what saved Katharine Hepburn's career.
That's right. Yeah, as we said, she won one Oscar in 1933, and then she got nominated for some more, but people were seemingly getting sick of her or just didn't like what she was doing. Something wasn't working. And then The Philadelphia Story comes along, another Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Stewart.
I guess supposedly she got to have say in who was cast for that movie.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how she had the power to do that since she wasn't doing well at that time, but she did. Yeah.
Strong-willed woman. That's indeed. One of the things about Katharine Hepburn is she didn't let anybody push her around, and that's one of the things, actually, even this is one of her first real comic ventures here, and she even had some difficulty playing this role because she hadn't done a whole lot of comedy up to this point. But the one thing that is definitely Katharine Hepburn that comes through in this character is these are strong-willed women. They know what they want and they're going to get it. And in this movie, what Katharine Hepburn's character wants, the character is named Susan Vance, what she wants is Cary Grant's character.
Dr. Huxley.
Professor Huxley, yes.
Let's see. So yes, if you got young women, or even if people are not identifying as women, you should have, if you have a child that has difficulty with confidence,
yeah,
you gotta, again, watch Barbara Stanwyck movies and Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah. I suppose we should say something about the plot here. And the plot is, it's really involved, obviously, because, like you said, it's a farce. You gotta have all kinds of weird stuff going on.
An actual leopard.
Yes.
Or two.
Yes.
Involved.
Okay, so the beginning of the movie, Professor Huxley, Cary Grant's character, he's a paleontologist, and he's about to finish off this brontosaurus, which actually at the time, they thought a brontosaurus was a real dinosaur, and then they decided a brontosaurus is not a real dinosaur, but now they've decided once again that there really is a dinosaur called a brontosaurus. So it's actually accurate now, even though it was not accurate later. Anyway, so Professor Huxley is looking for this one last bone to finish his brontosaurus in the museum.
Do you know if it was made out of paper mache?
The brontosaurus in the movie?
In the movie.
I do not know.
I didn't see anything about that.
That would be a logical thing, because this is a big, I mean, they show wide shots of this thing, and it is the size of a brontosaurus. It's humongous, and you got to get way up on a ladder or scaffolding to work on it, and that's where we find him at the beginning of the movie. He's sitting on top of the scaffolding, way up off the floor, looking at his brontosaurus, and we find out he's also supposed to get married later that day to his another professor who is working on the brontosaurus with me, and boy, is she not a lot of fun. She is even, and Professor Huxley is this very kind of absent-minded, a little bit weak-willed, a little bit bumbling, that kind of character, and he's really kind of henpecked by his fiancée here, who is just 100% business, and it's like, no, we're not even going to have a honeymoon because we have to finish this dinosaur, and really, there are going to be no entanglements in our marriage, and Dr. Huxley is like, does that mean what I think it means? And it's like, no, we're all business here. This is just about, you know, this is just about work. It's just a partnership. In anyway, we get an idea what this relationship is like immediately. Soon after this, we find out that there is a benefactor that is getting ready to get rid of Elizabeth. I forget what her last name is. This character named Elizabeth.
Yeah, Aunt Elizabeth Randon.
Oh, yes, Elizabeth Randon. Elizabeth Carlton Randon.
Sorry.
Yes, who is going to get rid of, give away $1 million, okay? And they want this $1 million to go to the museum. And so Dr. Huxley has instructions that he is supposed to go meet the lawyer who represents Mrs. Randon and play golf with him and to sweet talk him. Not that Dr. Huxley is really capable. Of a whole lot of, you know, social graces, but he's supposed to plead the case for why that $1 million should go to the museum so that they can keep working on dinosaurs. Okay. It turns out that this Randon, Elizabeth Randon, is also the aunt of Katharine Hepburn's character, Susan Vance. Okay. We don't know that until partway through the movie, but at the beginning of the movie, Cary Grant is playing golf, and immediately he runs into Susan Vance, and his ball gets lost, and she starts playing his ball on the course, and we find out immediately that Susan Vance does not listen to anybody or anything. She just does what she wants to do. Dr. Huxley tries to tell her that this is his golf ball, that he's hooked it, and it's ended up on her hole and not on the first hole. She's on the 18th, and she just doesn't listen to a word he says. Putts the ball. It's actually a beautiful putt by Katharine Hepburn. Quite a lengthy putt that she makes, and she was actually quite athletic. But anyway, and so the whole time, Dr. Huxley is trying to not offend the lawyer and trying to get his ball back from Susan. And Susan is playing his ball anyway and doesn't listen to anything he says. And so that's their first misadventure. And then she goes to leave, and then she gets in his car by mistake. And then she can't get out of the parking lot where she's parked and runs into six different cars along the way. And David is trying to tell her, no, this is my car. And he gets on the running board of the car. And there's, of course, this ridiculous scene where he's riding on the running board and waving to the lawyer and saying, I'll be with you in a minute, Mr. Peabody, while she's driving off with him on the running board, not listening to him, telling her that this is actually his car and not her car. And anyway, this is the way it goes. He meets her again later in the restaurant where he's supposed to have dinner with the lawyer. She's doing tricks with an olive. He slips on the olive on the floor. Then she rips his coat accidentally, and then he rips her dress accidentally. And then, oh, there's this wonderful scene. Oh, tell us about the scene.
About the scene where they're in lockstep. Okay, yes, so they're in lockstep. Cary Grant's behind. I mean, right as tight as you can get.
Yeah.
Spooning her big time.
Yeah, because, yeah.
Standing up. Yeah, I guess he accidentally was spooning.
Yeah, was standing on the trail of her dress.
And she's trying to, she's like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
So, yeah, she's got a...
He's trying to fix it.
Yeah, sure, her rear end is exposed.
Her knickers are showing.
Yes, and so the only way that they can do this is like, once he finally convinces her that her dress is, in fact, ripped, she's finally becomes embarrassed, and then so the only way they can get out of there is that, yeah, they walk together in lockstep. And this came about because
happened in front of Cary Grant at a museum, or I can't remember if it was at a museum or opera. There was a woman that had his fly was down. Okay, his fly was down. He zips it up, but he also zips up a woman's dress, and they can't unzip it. So they're in lockstep until they can go find some pliers, which I don't know. How do you find pliers? I don't know. But that came about.
Anyway, so he tells that story to Howard Hawks, the director. By the way, we haven't mentioned the director.
Because, again, this is pretty much people can either guess that we're doing a Billy Wilder or a Howard Hawks movie.
Yeah, it's Howard Hawks. With the same guy who directed The Thing from Another World.
Actually,
he produced The Thing from Another World, but he directed To Have and Have Not. This, again, another guy who did not get the credit that he deserved at the time. never won an Oscar for Best Director, but is now regarded one of the icons of directing from, you know, the first half of the 20th century in particular, Howard Hawks. So yeah, Cary Grant told the story to Howard Hawks, and it's like, oh, that bit's got to make it into the film, and so it does. So anyway, we've got a whole bunch of misadventures. And one of the things that's so great about this movie is that the action starts just like 5 minutes into it. The zaniness begins as soon as Susan Vance enters the world of Dr. Huxley. Everything that could go wrong can go wrong. All sorts of misunderstandings, all sorts of physical bits and verbal bits. And again, once it doesn't take long before she decides that she's in love with Dr. Huxley, and she says, that's the man I'm going to marry. He doesn't know it yet, but that's the man I'm going to marry. He thinks that she's nothing but trouble and wants to get away from her, but at the same time, there's something in the back of his head that says, boy, this woman is a whole lot more exciting than the woman that I'm engaged to. I'm supposed to get married later this day. She decides that she's going to keep the marriage from happening because she's going to get him occupied, because she calls him up the next day and says, well, you're a zoologist and I've got a leopard. And he doesn't believe her. And she says, no, I really got a leopard. And she does. She has a leopard in her apartment that got sent to her for some strange reason. And so he just says, you know, goodbye, Susan. You're nothing but trouble. I don't want to talk to you. And then she trips and falls. And he actually thinks just for a second that something has happened to her with the leopard. And then she figures out that he's concerned about that. And then so she plays it up for all it's worth, makes him think that the leopard is attacking her. And then it's like, oh, Susan, Susan, I'll be over there. And somehow he knows where she lives and he gets over there. And then she tricks him into having the leopard follow him, and they end up driving. Oh, she says, well, I'm going
to
drive
to Connecticut.
Yeah, we're going to take it to my farm in Connecticut. And, it, you know, he says he doesn't want to go along, but he goes along anyway. And they have a wreck on the road, and the leopard eats a whole bunch of chickens and ducks and
all that. Yeah, they're driving it. Not, they don't have the cat in a cage.
No, just in the back seat of the car, as you would do. But because it's a tame leopard, it is actually supposed to be a tame leopard. And the leopards are, Katharine Hepburn with his leopard is really good.
I guess she had a way with that leopard.
Yeah. I mean, in the apartment, she is, you can tell it's not a stand-in. This is actually Katharine Hepburn, and she is petting this full-grown leopard. It's rubbing up against her leg. She's petting it. She's, you know, holding its tail.
Well, I guess she impressed the trainer of the cat. The cat, the name is spelled N-I-S-S-A.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if that's
Nisa.
Nisa?
Well, that's what we'll
Nisa.
Say.
Nisa. So I guess there was a perfume that Katharine Hepburn wore that helped.
Oh, okay.
And she was very careful about not, like, moving too quickly. But I guess mm-hmm. there was one time where she accidentally, where Katharine Hepburn, I don't know, like, kind of slipped a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And the cat, and tried playing with her dress. And the trainer did have to intervene before it got, you know, to where it was dangerous. But
yeah. But by all accounts, she showed no fear of this leopard.
No.
In contrast to Cary Grant, who did not like being next to this leopard at all. The leopard, it made Cary Grant very nervous. And in some cases, it's doubles. In some cases, it's rear projection and camera tricks and all that kind of stuff. But including the scene in the car. Actually, the leopard,
well, they had,
I guess,
to shoot that, obviously, separately.
Yeah. So, but they do a good job with this,
they
especially
did.
For 1938. The special effects are pretty good with this. So somehow they make it all the way to the farm, and then Susan once again conspires. Oh, because they have to chase the leopard through a pond to get him away from the chickens.
No. The pond scene is when they actually have it at the farm, but the drunk hired man opens the stable door.
Okay.
And baby gets out.
Oh, no.
And gets to the pond. Yeah. That's when they're at the farm is when they go through the pond.
Oh, okay. Oh, well later. Actually, there is the scene in the car where they've just got feathers all over them.
Yeah.
And so they just describe having had to get... Anyway, the point is, he's really dirty. His clothes are dirty. They're filthy. And so when they get to the farmhouse, he still thinks he's going to get married later in the day. I don't know how many hours have gone by, but he still thinks he's going to make it back to New York to get married later that day. And of course, Susan knows there's no way in hell that she's going to let him go back to New York and get married. So she tricks him. He gets into the shower. She takes his clothes and tells somebody, take them into town to have them cleaned so that they won't be here. So he comes back and he has to wear a robe, a woman's robe. This is actually kind of a monumental little scene here, because he is wearing this woman's robe with the frilly shawl collar when Susan's aunt, Elizabeth Random, he doesn't know that this is Elizabeth Random. She still doesn't know that her aunt has any connection to this $1 million that he wants to get from the museum. He just meets this woman who walks in the door. She says, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" He's so flustered because he doesn't have any clothes anymore and he doesn't know how he's going to get back to New York and get married that he's hardly making any sense. And he doesn't often make a whole lot of sense anyway, because he's this, you know, kind of egghead professor who doesn't relate well to people. And so the classic line that he gives is she asks him, "Why are you wearing this woman's robe?" And he says, "I just went gay all of a sudden."
And I guess that went past code, because he just did it.
Oh yeah, he improvised it. Yeah.
So that's how it got past the code, and it was like the first time homosexuality was referenced.
Yeah, or at least
Or during code era.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize. I mean, there's some debate about actually when the term "gay" came into the vernacular as a slang expression for homosexuality. Apparently, it goes back to at least the 1920s or so. But a lot of people probably didn't even know that. But Cary Grant certainly did, and that's probably another reason why it makes it past the censors, is because not even everybody understands that "gay" is slang. Probably not the Catholics who were in charge of censoring the movies. They probably didn't know that "gay" meant what it meant. So anyway, all this is going on. So then they end up, they've got an escaped leopard later on. And then, of course, there happens to be a circus nearby. And they've also got a leopard, but their leopard is not tame. In fact, their leopard has just clawed somebody. And so they're out looking, Susan and David are out looking for the tame leopard all over the farm, at the same time that the truck carrying the leopard that's bad in a cage comes along the road. They think, "Oh my gosh, they've caught Baby. We have to get Baby loose." So he distracts the driver. She lets the bad leopard out of the cage. So now they got two leopards on the loose. It also turns out that Mrs. Random has a friend, Major Applegate, who just happens to be a big game hunter and knows all about leopards. He just happens to be there at the farm at the same time, along with, as you said, the caretaker,
Mr. Gott.
Gogarty. They're all running into this leopard at different times. They all think it's a tame leopard, but it's not a tame leopard. Then they think it's not the tame leopard, but it is the tame leopard.
That's a great bit. Yeah. You can use a leopard as a bit. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that leopard made the movie.
Oh, yeah. And
gave so much material.
And we've got all kinds of physical comedy going on between Hepburn and Grant as they're going across the farm. They're falling down hills. They have to go across the stream. And Susan says, "Oh, it's just this little stream. We can wade across it." And of course, they take one step and then it's up to their necks. And so then they have to take their clothes off and dry them in the fire. And of course, she burns his sock in the fire because she's not paying attention. And this is the kind of stuff that just keeps going on and on and on. Okay, oh, we didn't even mention earlier, they go into town because they have to get meat for Baby. So Cary Grant goes into the butcher shop to get the meat. Susan is just out there and she's, I don't know, there's a parade going by, or if it has to do with the circus or whatever. She's standing on the running board of the car. And then who comes along but the constable?
She's parked in front of a hydrant.
Yeah, she's parked right in front of a fire hydrant. What's the constable's name? This guy,
Walter
Catlett. Oh yeah, vaudeville veteran. In fact, he was even brought in specifically to work with Katharine Hepburn, and she liked him so much. She said, "Oh, this guy's got to be in the movie." And so they, I guess, added this part for the movie. He's just fantastic in it. He's this blowhard constable, and he's going to write her up for parking in front of a fire hydrant. But right as he starts to write the ticket, she notices that Baby jumps out of that car into a different car. And so she says, "Oh, no, that's not my car," after he's written the ticket up for it. So then they steal the car. The car just happens to belong to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist just happened to be the same one that they met at the restaurant the night before when she ripped her dress. All of this stuff, it's just all, it's like trains on, you've got six different trains in this elaborate track, and they just keep crossing each other, and you wait for the collision. So anyway, then eventually they make it back into town. They all get arrested. That's right. They all get, what was it they got arrested?
Oh my gosh. Oh, let's see. Okay. Oh, because she was throwing rock. Oh, the psychiatrist.
Oh, that's right.
And then Cary Grant is outside. And the psychiatrist must have called the police.
Okay. So, they show up.
She was singing, because Baby's on the roof, and the only way to get Baby anything, you got to sing, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby.
Yeah.
So they're singing, and the psychiatrist says, why are you singing? And, of course, they're in Connecticut. You're not going to believe that a leopard is on the roof. So
right. And it just happens to be the house of the psychiatrist. Yes. Okay. Oh, and earlier they had a different house where they were at.
Mr. Peabody, the lawyer,
where she was trying to get him to come out. And
because she knows him. She's going to make things right for
Boopy. Boopy. Oh, you mean Boopy? I know Boopy. I'll talk to him. And so they're throwing rocks at the window, and she says, the rocks weren't big enough. And then, of course, he opens the window and she hits him in the head with a rock. And it's like, oh, jeepers, we got to get out of here. But yeah, when they're chasing the leopard, of course it comes to a house. Of course it ends up on the roof. And of course the house just happens to belong to the psychiatrist. Okay. So then they get arrested. And then the constable, the same blowhard constable who was writing her the ticket, arrests them all. And she says, oh, you can't, don't arrest me. And you don't want to arrest me because my aunt is this, well-known, incredibly wealthy Susan Random, and so he calls up the Random house, talks to the housekeeper, and of course the housekeeper says, no, Mrs. Talks to Mrs. Random, and Mrs. Random says, my niece would never be doing something like that. She's in bed, and don't ever bother me again. And so he's convinced that she's making this story up. She doesn't have an aunt, and then that later the aunt actually shows up, and he's convinced that she can't really be the aunt, so he locks her up. Everybody ends up in jail, and then Susan Vance starts pretending. She decides the only way that she's going to get out of this, she's going to pretend that she's actually part of this gang. And so she starts making up this elaborate story about how they're gangsters. And of course the constable is so stupid that he falls for it. And then she escapes in the middle of her interrogation. She goes off and she finds a leopard, but of course she finds the wrong leopard, and she's dragging back this vicious leopard into the jail. Okay. Anyway.
Well, did you know, I guess Katharine Hepburn called him Jack the Nipper because that was Irene Dunne's nickname for him during The Awful Truth.
Okay.
When she plays the
Jerry,
drunk sister.
Jerry the Nipper.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I was going to say Jack the... Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's...
We're all part of the Leopard Gang.
Yeah.
Oh, here, now we're getting somewhere. Yeah. Anyway, so you understand why we call this a screwball comedy. Everything is screwy. Nothing makes sense. I mean, it is... And again, it's these farcical situations, these over-the-top characters. You know, the psychiatrist is this... very much a stereotype of the actor who plays him actually is German. Of course, he's got a German accent. You have to have a psychiatrist who's got a German accent.
Yeah, Fritz.
The caretaker, Barry Fitzgerald, is just kind of the iconic. He's actually was born in Ireland. He always played Irish characters. He was in Going My Way. He was in The Quiet Man. Okay, so of course, he's got to be, unfortunately, the stereotypical Irish caretaker who drinks too much and nobody believes what he says because he's always seeing things because he's always drunk. Mrs. Random, let's see, what was her name?
May Robson.
May Robson actually had been nominated for Best Actress. She was in her 70s already when she began her acting career. And this was a little bit of
again,
trivia.
Folks, there, yes. It's never too late.
It's never too late. She actually had been nominated for Best Actress for Lady for a Day. But she lost that year to, guess who? Who did she lose to? Who did she lose?
Katharine Hepburn.
When she won her first Oscar, it was the same year that May Robson did Lady for a Day. She's wonderful. She's just the battle axe, the big...
she reminds me of my aunt.
She does?
Yeah, a little bossy.
A little bossy?
Love you.
Oh my gosh. Is your aunt going to listen to this podcast?
No.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
No, she doesn't remind me of my aunt.
Okay. But then Major Applegate, another famous character actor. What was that guy's name?
Applegate.
Major Applegate.
Charles Ruggles.
Charles Ruggles, who did over 100 films in his day. What do you know about Charles Ruggles?
Well, I don't know much, but I do know that we need to take a break.
Oh, okay.
Before we talk about Charles Ruggles.
Okay,
we'll be back. And welcome back.
Okay.
Here we are. Let's talk about Ruggles.
Yeah.
Major Applegate. I love that name.
Yeah.
Okay, so I actually did see him in The Parent Trap, and I'm not talking about the 90s Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap, folks.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about the Hayley Mills.
Because you are who you are, you know the 1960s version better than the 1990s version.
Well, I actually like them both a lot, so I actually know them both quite well.
Okay.
Okay. But if you like the 90s version, you'll like the 60s version.
Yeah. But Charles Ruggles, like so many of these characters, I mean, this really is an ensemble, even though it's
that he took it seriously. I mean, it was just perfect.
Yeah.
He was so funny, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't appreciate how hard it is to do comedy.
Yeah. And he is, another bumbling character. He's a big game hunter, but he's really this really kind of a timid sort of guy. And, of course,
without a gun, he's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his specialty is that they start talking about leopards. Oh, and, of course, Susan tells her aunt that... that David has just had a nervous breakdown, and they have to humor him and go along with anything that he says. David, of course, doesn't know that they have told this to the aunt. He is just being his, you know, absent-minded self, and he is obsessed. Oh, because we didn't mention
a bone,
Yes. Okay. Oh yeah, the bone. The bone comes in the mail. The last piece that he needs for his Brontosaurus. It comes in the mail. He's got it. He's carrying it around. He happens to have it with him when this whole thing. So he's carrying around this little box with the bone in it the whole time. When they get to the farm, though, Susan obviously, you know, sees a box, she has to open it, and then the other famous character finds it.
Asta. Asta was in the Thin Man movies and The Awful Truth. A dog,
George,
by the way.
George the dog. A wire-haired terrier.
Also did great work with the leopard.
Yeah. I mean, before Lassie, the most famous movie dog of all time was Asta. It did all those Thin Man movies. If you've ever seen a picture of the Thin Man movie, you saw Asta the dog in there. George is just...
I hope that dog had a good contract.
Oh, actually, I looked this up. He was making $250 a week, okay, in 1938. So,
wow.
Yeah, he was making big bucks. I don't know what he was spending it all on, but he was making big bucks, okay? But anyway, yeah, George the dog finds the bone and runs off with it somewhere. They figure that's part of the reason that they're out looking for George. George is digging up, you know, holes all over the place where he's buried various things. And anyway, so George is with them. Why were we talking about? I don't even remember why we were talking about George, but...
Because you were talking about how Susan told her aunt about...
Yeah. Yeah.
Without telling him that his last name is now Bone.
Oh, yes. She made up a name for him.
And that
Mr. Bone.
He's a big game hunter, which also Applegate is a game hunter, so he's trying to talk game with him to bring him into conversation, but Cary Grant's distracted by paying attention to where the dog goes, so he
can't
find
where the
bone
goes. And
he
doesn't know that he's supposed to be a big game hunter. So, of course, none of it makes sense. He keeps getting up and leaving the room because he sees George, the dog, go somewhere. And anyway.
And it goes with the whole that he's had a crazy...
Yeah, he's had a breakdown they have to humor him and all that. And and Major Applegate is...
He starts to do moon calls and leopard calls.
Oh, yeah.
There wouldn't be a leopard in Connecticut.
Yeah, they hear the leopard call and it's like, what is that noise? And he says, oh, it's a loon. And then, of course, he says, well, the leopard cry, you know, if I can demonstrate. And so then he starts doing the leopard cry. And of course, as soon as he does the leopard cry, then the leopard answers the call. And then later on, they find out somehow in the midst of all of this, David finds out that, oh, Susan Random, this is the woman who's supposed to give her $1 million. Oh, Susan finds out, oh, My aunt was supposed to give me $1 million. We're competing for the same $1 million here. Oh, that lawyer, Susan Vance, is okay. It's like it all comes together in this big mess at the end, and it's a farce. Again, it's a farce, and it's a screwball comedy, and everybody is wild and wacky. And again, you've got these veteran character actors, all of whom are just virtuosos at this kind of vaudeville-type shtick. Cary Grant, we talk a little bit about Cary Grant.
Yeah, tell me about Cary Grant.
A lot of people think Cary Grant was like...
Just a pretty face.
Just a pretty face and body.
Just a piece of meat.
Yeah. But actually, he was a fantastic actor, performer, who could do both drama and comedy. This is a guy born in England, basically runs away and joins a troupe of comics and acrobats when he's 14 years old, then ends up coming to the United States doing that, starts doing stuff on Broadway. But what he has to do, the physical stuff that he does, and he did some vaudeville also. It takes a lot of talent, especially to do comedy. If you've got somebody who's not much of an actor, you can throw them into some sort of melodrama or whatever and just tell them to be serious and repeat the lines, and they could probably get by. But comedy is a lot harder. You have to understand what's funny and why it's funny and what your part plays into making the whole joke come off. It's a lot more complicated. There's a lot more going on. It's much more important that you're able to play off of other people. And Cary Grant is just fantastic at this. He is much, much more than just this handsome. There are lots of handsome guys that were making movies at the time. Cary Grant was a uniquely talented actor. And like we were saying at the beginning, he's already in his mid-30s, even though he's made a bunch of movies, he hasn't really had a big hit yet. And it's not until they come back around later in, I think it's 1940, to do the Philadelphia Story. That's the reclamation project for Katharine Hepburn. Cary Grant gets cast in that. You're saying Katharine Hepburn has a role in deciding who else ends up in there. And then it's like, oh, then things start going. And then he's doing everything. He does all the Hitchcock pictures, which he's just fabulous in, and the rest is history from there. But Cary Grant, I mean, he deserves so much more credit than he gets for how talented he was. He was not just a charming guy. And yeah, what do you think of Katharine Hepburn?
I want to be Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah. Oh, another one. You want to be her too?
I want to be her too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I would have watched movies with her in them when I was younger, but here we are.
Yeah.
Loretta's going to watch movie. Has. So Loretta's going to be a little bit of Katharine Hepburn. I was reading about how she, I guess if you're a big Katharine Hepburn, old movie fan, you know that she wore pants a lot in films.
Yeah.
And
slacks.
That was,
yeah.
Slacks, mm-hmm. And that was mm-hmm. That was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And she does wear slacks.
Well, in real life,
she's got
too.
A scene. Yeah. Yeah. She's got a scene with that.
Yeah, people in Hollywood thought she was weird because she wore slacks a lot and she didn't wear makeup most of the time, except when, like, she was making movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, I just think they're both fabulous. I love this movie. I love, since being a mom, I'm not as big of a cat person as I used to be. I used to just adore cats, okay? I don't know what it is. I don't know what happened to me. I don't know what happened to me, okay?
You hate them, though.
But now people are like, why isn't she denying it? I don't know. I don't know why I can't deny it. Okay. Big cat person, big cat rescue person.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, I save little
mm-hmm,
neonatal kittens. Okay.
Yeah,
save them, bring them to
by,
life.
You know, a pet rescue
yes.
organization.
Anyway,
yes.
Okay. So this isn't even part of the film that this isn't why I like the film, but I'm thinking about it more as I try to pay attention to, wow,
mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm,
is actually
mm-hmm,
a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been a little chicken with
mm-hmm.
doing scenes with a leopard, okay?
Because uh-huh.
we have an outdoor feral cat here. Well,
yeah.
She's not feral, but
mm-hmm.
she's got some feral
mm-hmm.
stuff she can't let go. Tendencies,
uh-huh.
okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm a
this
little
is a great
chicken.
Big cat, I'm
a little
great,
yeah,
big,
yeah,
scary
big,
looking cat.
Big,
yeah.
Like what are the Maine Coon? That's what I was looking for. Those
oh, yeah.
Maine Coon cats.
Really?
Yeah,
oh,
big like that.
That sounds scary.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, but, and I guess I should try wearing a perfume to try to.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's really, I think that the bit adds is added with the leopard. I just think it's a fun movie.
Yeah. Well, and Katharine Hepburn, I mean, she eventually does win three more Oscars. Well, she gets nominated like 12 times.
I am stunned every time you hear that an actor wasn't just automatic. You don't really think about what goes into actually having, it's not just where somebody sees them act, they're just fine. Everything comes easily, natural mm-hmm. to them. This wasn't a natural movie for her. She had to go through a lot to even play this role. She had to go through a lot to continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually,
because they already shot through a lot of it, and they had to like redo it because they didn't like how she was doing it. Anyway,
yeah.
Part of me is amazed by it, but then part of it's like, you know, if she wouldn't have gotten better, then she wouldn't have shared an Oscar with Barbara Streisand, and Barbara Streisand would have had her own Oscar.
I forgot.
And Funny mm-hmm. Girl, so mm-hmm. maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, that would have been.
But there is a lesson here. I mean,
yeah, what does it teach us about life?
Well, I mean, just about Katharine Hepburn. Oh. I mean, she had to learn to do the comedy because Howard Hawks was not happy with the way she was doing it originally. That's why he brought somebody in to coach her. He thought she was kind of overacting a little bit. She was going through this period where she was not nearly as popular.
I can't wrap my head around that.
Yeah, and then she goes on again to be just this icon.
She has, I don't know if she still has the record for the most Oscars won by an individual, or at least for a female.
I think she
won four.
She won four, and she got nominated 8 other times for Best Actress. So clearly...
Poison.
Yeah. And there's a difference between being good and being popular, too.
Well, because Cary Grant didn't win an Oscar.
No, he never won an Oscar. Although he was involved in dozens and dozens of really good movies and some that were great.
So what do you like about this movie?
Well, you know, I just think it is hilarious. Okay. It's nonstop action. And like I said, it's not just the big two. It's not just.
Yes. It's Grant the whole cast.
It is. Yeah. All these other
characters. Perfectly cast.
Everybody is perfect. Everybody is spot on. All the bits are. And I think Howard Hawks deserves the credit for that. I mean, he was just fantastic with working people into the right situations, getting the dialogue just right, getting the pacing up. I mean, this movie never slows down. He gets the credit for that. What I think is fascinating about this, again, we said this is an era of screwball comedies. It's so many of these screwball comedies involve high society people, really wealthy people. That's just part of the formula that becomes part of what you expect out of these comedies.
I guess Katharine Hepburn was cast as a hillbilly, miscast as a hillbilly in a movie, and I guess that was a really bad choice. Yes. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and Katharine Hepburn actually was from Connecticut, where this was filmed. She had the accent already. She had wealthy parents. I think her father was a doctor. Her mother was a suffragette. But think about this. It's 1938. This is in the middle of the Depression. And this is at the same time that they're developing this genre of the screwball comedy. And so many of these films are about incredibly wealthy people. We're going to have Grant and Hepburn together in a holiday later on where they're, you know, millionaires and billionaires. And they're talking about whether or not he wants to join the family business and he wants to do something simpler with his life. It happened one night that came along a few years before this with Carol Lombard and Clark Gable. And she's the wealthy socialite. We've got all these other movies. My Man Godfrey, where we've got William Powell, who's this guy who actually loses his fortune, I guess, in this crash, and he gets picked up in a homeless encampment by this incredibly wealthy young woman. We have all these really, really rich people in these movies, and I think it's just fascinating that while the nation is going through a depression and unemployment is at 25% and people are standing in bread lines, they're still scraping together 25 cents to go see a movie. And what do they want to see in a movie? They want to see rich people. They want to see rich people interacting with one another. And in some cases, rich people being made fun of, rich people being brought down to earth. They want to see rich people interacting with people of lower classes. In some cases, being taught lessons about what it means to be a real human being. That's part of what you see. Well, not so much in this film, but in some of these other films, you see that kind of stuff going on. And that really was just kind of surprising to me when I started putting this together in my head. It's like, oh my God, it's the Depression. Why would anybody want to watch this kind of movie? Well, you want to escape. And even though you would think if you are unemployed or scraping by or whatever in 1938 that you would resent rich people, that's not the way it worked. People in America still thought there was something magical, and they had this aspiration that someday they might also become rich. They were curious, just fascinated with the lives of rich people. What would it be like? And so they wanted to see these people, but they also wanted to be entertained. They wanted escapism, and that's what these screwball comedies give you. So that's one factor. Another factor is, this is when the Hays Code and the censorship really starts coming into play. And we talked before in some of our other podcasts about the fact that in the 1920s and 30s, early 30s especially, some of the movies got to be really racy. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that was a lot more risque in those movies than in the movies that came in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, and it was because of the censorship complaints. People started complaining, or especially the Catholic League of Decency or whatever they were called, they were complaining that these movies were corrupting people, and so they insisted on censoring out some of the more risque stuff. Well, Hollywood has to react to that by taking out the overt references to sexuality and that sort of stuff, and they start seeing comedies as this way to put sexual tension into movies with, and some people have referred to this as sexual comedies without the sex. So you've got role reversals where you've got women pursuing men, like in this movie. You've got domineering women and less confident men. You've got movies about divorce, and like we said, one of our favorites, My Favorite Wife. The sexual tension in My Favorite Wife, which is about Cary Grant's wife, Irene Dunne, she's off on a cruise. She gets shipwrecked. She's gone for 7 years, given up for dead. And then she comes back right before Cary Grant is about to get remarried again to a considerably less fun woman. And then not only does she come back and Cary Grant has to decide, oh, what am I going to do? I'm about to get married. How do I tell my wife? Then they find out that she was shipwrecked on the island with another man played by Randolph Scott. And so then there's this whole bit about who is the man. And she finds somebody, some dumpy little guy, to pretend that he was the man. And then Cary Grant finds out that, okay, the sexual tension in these movies is just through the Awful Truth is another one. Supposedly they both were having affairs, Irene Dunne and Cary Grant, and so they're going to get a divorce, but they're really still in love with each other. They kind of handle the notion of the affairs rather delicately, but then they start to make each other jealous. They start to pretend that they're in other relationships. And again, it's like, you can't show the sex on TV. We can't talk about that stuff. We got to make the censors happy. But all of those themes are there. They're undercurrents. They're just right beneath the surface. And it makes it even more exciting because they can't deal with it explicitly.
This is what led to reality TV.
Oh my God. This
is it. That was the catalyst.
Oh wow.
Did you ever think about that?
I did not think about
that. But as you're saying it.
Yeah.
I'm putting two and two together.
Well, I guess maybe it wasn't such a good thing after all. I take back
everything. It's the end of this podcast then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what does it teach us about?
What does it teach us about life?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess.
Yeah, what's the philosophical?
Part of this is the whole opposites attract thing. Is that a myth or is it reality? And I think there's some truth to that. We want partners who bring out something different, something that's maybe latent or missing in our own character. I think it gets to be a cliche, but I think there's some truth to that. So I think that's part of it. We also have these questions about, even though we're kind of fantasizing about what it's like to be rich and have somebody giving us $1 million and just the enormous wealth that we're surrounded with, what really makes the movie work is because we've got two very real, interesting people. And so many of these other people, like the aunt and the lawyer and the psychiatrist, they're all stuffy, really rigid people. They're no fun at all. That's kind of what we associate the super wealthy with. But if we can find somebody who's got that spark of humanity and is unspoiled, uncorrupted by wealth, that's one of the things that makes people attractive. And again, a common trope in romantic comedies is, I need love, I don't need the money. I think you can find that in here. And yeah, just...
Yeah, because she gives him... Susan gets $1 million. But does she keep it or does she give it away?
Oh, we won't spoil that. You'll have to watch the final 30 seconds of the movie to find that out. Yeah. So, again, it's not a super deep film, but I think it is great social commentary. If you watch it once and just enjoy it, but then also think about the fact, again, yeah, this is in the middle of the Depression, and it's in an era of tight censorship of movies, and it's also two stars who are going to become mega personalities, mega movie stars, famous, but they're not there yet. And what it is that unlocks that for them.
It's the leopard.
Yes.
It's Nisa.
It's, yeah, Nisa. And it's George, too. Yeah.
And George, it's, yeah.
Yeah, Asta. So, yeah, just watch it, enjoy it. It's, again, watch this one, and then I don't know if
we'll ever... Wait, hold on. Can we go back to the fact that the leopard was going to be a pet? So, I mean, that goes in with your whole, like, rich person, what rich people do. Like, can you imagine, I mean, other than, I don't know, obviously be illegal today, it must not have been illegal then.
Well, you've still got,
I got Tiger King, I forgot
Joe
about
Exotic.
That.
Joe Exotic. Yeah. Yeah, it's the same sort of deal. They got this huge farm here, and they have they do have laws in some states.
We did not say that the leopardess baby was sent to Susan by her brother for her aunt.
That's right.
Like it.
Oh yeah, that was actually the aunt's leopard. We find that out three-fourths of the way through the movie.
What the heck was the aunt going to do? Was she going to?
She just wants a pet leopard. What do rich people do? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do these rich people do? They, you know, again, that's part of the message too. I think for the masses, you know, you're going in there, you're scraping by, you're watching these rich people, and it's like, what ridiculous lives they lead. It's like a part of you
says, hearing how much meat that animal takes, and they're in bread lines.
Yes. Just think of the litter box, too, you would need for that thing. But I digress. But yeah, no, I think that's part of it, too. You're watching these wealthy people, and part of you wants to be rich. Part of you wishes you could be that. But then part of you also wants to say, those people are so out of touch with reality. What kind of fantasy lives do they lead? What kind of things do they do to entertain themselves? Well, they probably do things like get pet leopards and, you know, what have you. So, there you have it.
I'll just bring up a baby.
Yes, bring up your own baby human. You can do that.
She does look like, I do have a leopard outfit for her though.
That's right.
Pretty darn cute.
Yeah, I've seen her in
pretty
that.
Darn cute.
Yes, she it is pretty darn cute.
And she likes to dance, so I'm sure that song would probably work for her.
Yeah.
For if I needed to like tame her or bring her to certain rooms if I wanted to, but anyway. Well, thank you for your insight on that movie.
Oh, thank you. As always.
Thank you.
Thank you for producing, as always, too.
Well, hopefully the sound's a little bit better.
Got
but
these fancy
we're going to work
microphones
on it. We're going to work on
studio.
It. I think I banged my headphones somewhere, so there might be a little sound. We're like, oh, my gosh. But
We're working on it.
I want to thank Joan, my friend Joan, for watching Loretta today to make this happen. Okay. And
shout out to Joan.
Shout out to Joan, who probably won't listen to this podcast.
All right. We'll see you all next time doing whatever we come up with.
All right. And hey, you screening rumors? Is that, do we call the people that listen to this
that's
podcast?
Exactly what
screening rumors.
Uh-huh. That's the name of the fan club.
If you want to talk to us, you know, message us. Again, Twitter, Instagram should be in our show notes of how you can get in touch with us. Mm-hmm. All right? If you got to,
throw it in the bottle. Toss it in the ocean. It'll get here.
It'll get here. Mm-hmm. Okay? Even though we live by a lake. But,
all right.
See you next time.